chapter 2, please. Luke chapter 2. So in a couple of weeks, Matt and I are going to start a class on the Gospel of John. A few other brothers here have been helping immensely put that together. And I'm really looking forward to jumping into John's Gospel for 3 months together. As I worked through preparing this class with a few others, one thing that I came to realize was my knowledge of John the man was mediocre at best. I know so much more about Paul, about Moses, about David than I do John the Apostle. And so what I would like to do tonight is just give you an introduction to John the Apostle, John the Evangelist, John the Disciple, John the Writer, many different names he goes by. But just really give you just a basic introduction biography to John, who he is. Don't worry about taking every last note of what I have up here. I'll have this for you in the workbooks in a few weeks. But let's just come to know John the Apostle a little bit. To understand John, you first have to understand the New Testament has two major Johns. Now, a third John, no pun intended, a third John comes on the scene in Acts, John Mark. It gets really confusing once John Mark comes on the scene. Why it just couldn't be Mark, I don't know, but it has to be John Mark, because at times he's called John, and other times he's Mark, and other times he's John Mark. So really there's three, but in the Gospels there's two major Johns. The first one is John the Baptist. When you look at Luke chapter 2, his birth is prophesied about, and we come to know really some of what he does and much of the work that he gives. Look with me, please. In Luke chapter 2. Look at me in Luke chapter 2. I'm sorry, that should be Luke 1. Luke 1, 57. Now the time came for Elizabeth to give birth, and she bore a son. And her neighbors and relatives heard that the Lord had shown great mercy to her, and they rejoiced with her. And on the eighth day they came to circumcise the child, and they would have called him Zechariah after his father, but his mother answered, no, he shall be called John. So here you have Elizabeth, who, you have to understand this, this is John the Baptist, his mother Elizabeth and Jesus' mother Mary were relatives, thought to be sisters or cousins. So here, John the Baptist is what we would call a cousin to Jesus of Nazareth. That's John the Baptist. John the Baptist wrote nothing that's left recorded for us today. He may have done some writing I don't know about, but nothing that John the Baptist wrote is left recorded for us. Rather, the John that we are talking about is John the Apostle. So don't get these two confused, okay? Oftentimes in the Gospels or when you read of John, it can be either John the Baptist or John the Apostle. Don't get the two confused. The one we're talking about is John the Apostle. He's really not introduced until you get over to Luke chapter 5. Look with me over to Luke chapter 5. This is Jesus calling out his first apostles to fish. Luke chapter 5, verse 9. For Peter and all who were with him were astonished at the catch of fish that they had taken. And so were James and John, the sons of Zebedee, who were partners with Simon. So you'll notice here in the story, you have Peter, James, and John in a sailboat. And they, of course, are Peter. We know who Peter is. But then you have James and John, the sons of Zebedee. This is John the Apostle. Now, trying to figure out his bloodline and exactly who he is a headache and a half. I need Valinda Peterson's help figuring out this genealogy. It's really complicated. Let me just tell y'all the general theory. His blood relation to Jesus is uncertain. Now, I've heard the dominant view is that he was a blood cousin to Jesus. This is a conjecture at best, okay? It is not certain that he was a blood cousin to Jesus. John the Baptist was a blood cousin to Jesus, but John the Apostle may not have been a blood cousin to Jesus. Nowhere in the Gospels does it say that John was related in the flesh to Jesus. This is rather an inference at best that has been drawn between two crucifixion accounts. Let me show y'all where this idea comes from. Look with me in Matthew chapter 27. Matthew chapter 27. So this is just an inference in the text along with some early tradition that claims that he was a cousin to Jesus. Look at Matthew 27. Here at the crucifixion, we read, there was Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James and Joseph, and the mother of the sons of Zebedee. So the mother of the sons of Zebedee, who is that? The mother of James and John. Okay, so John the Baptist, John the Apostle's mother. Keep your finger here. Go with me over to Mark 14. Look at Mark 14, verse 30. Mark chapter 14. I'm sorry, y'all, I have another verse here. I'm sorry, it's Mark 15. Mark 15, I just had another typo. Mark 15, verse 40. So here you have, there were also women looking on from a distance, among whom were Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James the Younger, and Joseph and Salome. Okay? Some think that if you look at this list, Salome, S-A-L-O-M-E, Salome, would be the sister of Mary, the mother of Jesus. If that's the case, Salome, Mary, the mother of Jesus, is thought to be the same woman who is the mother of the sons of Zebedee back in Matthew chapter 27. That's a big guess. That's a really big guess. Were they blood relatives? Possibly. I don't know. And I would argue even more so, it really doesn't impact John's life at all. What matters much more than his blood relation to Jesus is his religious background. And we know with certainty John the Apostle was a disciple to John the Baptist. Look over at John 1. This, I would argue, is far more important to understanding who John is, John the Apostle, than knowing his blood relationship to Jesus, which really at best is uncertain. Look at John 1. John chapter 1. The next day again, John the Baptist was standing with two of his disciples. He looked at Jesus and said, "Behold, the Lamb of God." The two disciples heard this and followed Jesus. Now, if you look down to verse 40, one of these disciples is Andrew. The other one is left unnamed. We know with certainty this is John the Baptist. Okay? John the Apostle. Normally when I mix up Bible names, it's Noah and Moses for some reason. Those are the two I always mix up, but I'm doing it tonight with the two Johns. John the Apostle would have been a disciple to John the Baptist. Now, does this sound a little bit confusing? I hope not. It's really not that confusing. But let me tell y'all why this is so important. Whenever you go through the gospel accounts and you read of John's conversion to Jesus, whenever he leaves everything and follows Jesus, if you don't realize that John the Apostle was a disciple to John the Baptist, it appears that John is this wacko who hears of this hippie teacher saying, "Follow me, I will give life." And he off a whim is just like, "Great, peace and love, that's what I'll do." That's not what John did at all. John had been preparing for the coming of the Messiah for years. John the Baptist, through his preaching. John the Apostle, through his discipleship to John the Baptist. So whenever Jesus comes on the scene, it's not this whimsical decision of, "Oh great, he has a hip message I'm going to follow." He had been spiritually preparing for the coming of the Messiah for years at best. And so we know from his upbringing, he would have been raised in a Jewish home. We know with certainty he would have been a disciple of John the Baptist. So then whenever Jesus comes on the scene, he's naturally ready then to follow the Messiah. So then as you look at John as a disciple, we actually know quite a bit about his life during the lifetime of Jesus. Next to Peter, we probably know as much about John the Apostle as anyone else. Let me share with y'all just a few things I find interesting about John the Apostle. Look with me at Luke 9. This is one of my favorite stories about him. Luke chapter 9. Go to 51. Luke 9, 51. When the days drew near for him to be taken up, Jesus set his face to go to Jerusalem. And he sent messengers ahead of him, who went and entered a village of the Samaritans to make preparations for him. But the people did not receive him because his face was set toward Jerusalem. And when his disciples James and John saw it, they said, "Lord, do you want us to tell fire to come down from heaven and consume them?" But he turned and rebuked them, and they went on to another village. Do you notice here the story? Here, Jesus is wanting to go to the Samaritans. James and John say, however, "Oh Lord, don't go to them. Rather," verse 54, "do you want us to tell fire to come down from heaven and consume them?" John is nicknamed the Son of Thunder. The two sons of Zebedee get the nickname of Jesus, Sons of Thunder. The name Peter, for example, was a nickname given. His birth name was Simon. The name Peter comes from the Greek Petros, meaning rock. John is given the nickname, along with his brother James, by Jesus, Son of Thunder. Why do you think that was? Because he is asking fire to come down from heaven and consume the Samaritans. Can you imagine what it would be like to be with John? I mean, when I think of Peter, Peter is otter. Peter is the sanguine otter to the max. I think John was much more of a melancholy, deeply convicted, deeply knowing, deeply feeling individual who believes with all his conviction that Jesus Christ of Nazareth needs to do away with these Samaritans who are going in his way. So I think Peter and John would have had very different personalities, probably a different dynamic between them with Jesus. But still, John is going to be a son of thunder. But you take this to the end of John, what's the irony and the reason I love this? The man who wants fire to come down from heaven and consume the Samaritans, he is the one who later in his life will be nicknamed the Apostle of Love. As you go through really the Gospel of John, 1 John, 2 John, 3 John, and Revelation, love is just saturating through each of those books. We also know that John was a close disciple to Jesus. We won't take the time to turn there, but in Matthew 17, that is the story of the Transfiguration. John is one of the few close disciples that goes to the Mount of Transfiguration and sees this great scene. Matthew 26, 36 through 37, James, John, and Peter go with Jesus to the Garden of Gethsemane when he prays in his final hours. So we know from this, he was a true, literal witness. So let me tell y'all why this is so important. If you look over to John chapter 20, look with me at John chapter 20. This is the reason the Gospel of John was written. Notice with me what this text says. John chapter 20, verse 30. "Now Jesus did many other signs in the presence of the disciples that are not written in this book. But these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name." John writes his gospel to give a witness. John is going to be one of the chief eyewitnesses of Jesus during his life. He saw things that went on in the life of Jesus that perhaps with the exception of Peter, no one else was able to see. So when you look at the Gospel of John, you have to understand this is written by someone who is a firsthand eyewitness, intimate disciple of Jesus, who understands the innermost workings of the life and ministry of Jesus. The last thing that I want to point out about this is he was at the cross. This is really important to know. Probably the most famous story of John is if you look to John 19, verse 17. John chapter 19, verse 17. Here as you get to the cross. "So they took Jesus, and he went out bearing his own cross." Skip down with me to verse 25. "But standing by the cross of Jesus were his mother's sister, Mary the wife of Clopas, and Mary Magdalene. When Jesus saw his mother and the disciple whom he loved, that is John the apostle, standing nearby, he said to his mother, 'Woman, behold your son.' Then he said to the disciple, 'Behold your mother.' And from that hour, the disciple took her to his own home." This is an interesting, interesting story. You have to understand the cultural depth here. Under first century Jewish tradition, this goes back to the law of Moses. Probably Joseph, the father of Jesus, is dead by this point. So that's why Mary is needing a kinsman redeemer who is going to look after her after Jesus dies and leaves this earth. So then he calls John, who's at the cross, "Woman, behold your son." He then is going to be a kinsman redeemer to Mary and will then look after Mary. Why John? Few different theories. I don't know if anyone knows the right answer. The most popular theory is that John was a blood relative of Jesus, so this would have been Mary's nephew. Uncertain. Don't know for certain. Second theory is that John was intimate with Jesus, and so it would make sense for him to have given his mother to someone he knew well. Third theory, he was at the cross. So he looks to John and says, "You're the one here, watch her." Fourth theory, and this is the one I actually think is most feasible. John lived past the lives of all the other apostles. John outlives Peter, he outlives James, he outlives all the other apostles. So John was around to look after Mary, the mother of Jesus, during this time period. And y'all, I hope you understand how much the New Testament doesn't tell us. Can you imagine another book written about John taking care of her? I mean, it would have been the book of Ruth rewritten to have John the Apostle taking care of the mother of Jesus Christ. I mean, to know all that John was doing that time, but then John also was caring for the mother of Jesus. It's a phenomenal thing to think about. And so then he also sees Jesus after the resurrection. After hearing from the women, John and Peter are the first two apostles to see the empty tomb and to understand Jesus has been resurrected. A lot else to say about John, but just my main points are this. He's a fiery man. He was close to Jesus. He was an eyewitness. He was a deep, loving individual who's transformed by the resurrection. Then as you get to the first century, as you go through the book of Acts, remember our outline, Acts 1 through 7, you're in Jerusalem, 8 through 12, Judea, Samaria, 13 through 28, into the earth. As you look at Acts 1 through 7, there's quite a bit said about John. 8 through 12, a little bit in chapter 8. From there, almost nothing is said about him. So we know quite a bit about John during the early days of the church, but the historical line fades after the first few years of the church. If you look to the gospel of to the book of Acts, rather, look with me in Acts chapter 3. Acts chapter 3. This is right after, in the narrative, Peter has given his great sermon and the great conversion has happened. Look with me at Acts chapter 3, verse 1. Peter and John were going up to the temple at the hour of prayer, the ninth hour. John is one of the pillars of the church, along with Peter. So when you look at the first century church of Jerusalem, Peter and John would have been two of, if not the pillars of that church. A bit later in the narrative, and if you go to Acts chapter 8, John is going to go to Samaria, and he will then take the gospel to Samaria. Why is that so ironic? Because earlier he wanted to send fire down to anyone who was not a Jew. But now he is going to take the gospel to those who are really non-true Jews. It's a beautiful transformation. Let me just take this just for a second, y'all. One thing you have, when you read any New Testament narrative, you have to read it with the perspective of how does the cross transform this individual. With Peter, Peter goes from a all-over-the-place otter to a pillar of the church. Paul goes from a out-of-control lion to a deep, loving, humble man. John, on the other hand, goes from a deep, convicted hater to a deep, loving servant. That's the transformation of John. And I don't have the time to explicate on that fully, but just understand that transformation that would have gone on in the life of John because of the cross and the transformation. There was that transformative power of the cross in his life. And then if you cross-reference Galatians chapter 2, this is when Paul goes to Jerusalem, probably at least a decade after the foundation of the church of Jerusalem. John is still there serving as most likely an elder at the church and is working with the church at Jerusalem. From there, you have to do some inference. Some tradition tells us that he went to Ephesus for a little while and then was exiled to the island of Patmos. The dominant idea is that the Gospel of John was written at Ephesus. The book of Revelation was written at the island of Patmos. We know that one with certainty. John would have left, but it would have been a long time afterward. Now, why did he not leave Jerusalem for so long? Why did he not leave Jerusalem for so long? Peter, we think, left after a while. We know Paul left. But why did John not leave? Do you think it was because of the promise he made to Jesus? That he had to watch after the mother of Jesus? I think that's probably one of the reasons that John stays at Jerusalem so long, is because of that pact that he made with Mary. And so then understand, as you go through John's writings, Mary comes up quite a bit. The father-son, the mother-child relationship comes up quite a bit in the writings of John. Do you think Mary, the mother of Jesus, impacted that some? I think absolutely. You have to read that biographical perspective to understand John's writings. And then sadly, as you go into Acts chapter 12, James, the brother of John, is really the first of the apostles recorded to be martyred in the Gospel of Acts. But still, John does not lose his faith. If anything, it seems that he is just as convicted about his belief in Jesus as he was before that. So, that's John in the book of Acts at a whirlwind pace. Otis, we're drinking from a fire hose tonight. A few other things about John before we close. John, of course, was an author. John wrote these books. He wrote the Gospel of John, which is thought to be the last recorded of the Gospels. That's my theory as well. He wrote 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John, and he also wrote the book of Revelation. So John was prolific. I mean, his writings take up about a fifth of the New Testament. So when you look at Luke, who wrote Luke and Acts, Paul and John, they're really the three major writers of the New Testament. Probably in John's case, because he was the one who was around so much later than the other apostles. Before we close, I do want to tell y'all my favorite verse about John that I have come to find hysterical. Go with me to Acts chapter 4. Acts chapter 4. Peter and John are speaking before the council. And as the Jews listen to what Peter and John say, listen with me to Acts chapter 4, verse 13. Now when the Jews saw the boldness of Peter and John, they perceived that they were uneducated, common men, and they were astonished. The man who wrote the book of Revelation, the greatest of literary features in the history of the world, was thought to have been an uneducated, common man. Isn't that hysterical? The Jews are so caught up in their hatefulness of anything Christian that they cannot see that Peter and John are the most knowledgeable of men there. And so when you look at Peter's convictions here, yes, he was a fisherman, but y'all don't underestimate John's knowledge. John worked as a son of Zebedee, who probably was a rich man, and he would have been raised as a Jew. He did not have mediocre scriptural knowledge. John is a scriptural giant. I mean, I'm talking Apollos level. When you go through John's writings, he just breathes Old Testament. I mean, Paul does as well, but John just breathes Old Testament, especially the book of Revelation. When I finally teach it in probably about another year or so, you'll just see in Revelation, he just takes a bit of the piece of the Pentateuch, ties it together with the historical books, puts in a bit of a psalm, puts in a few words of a prophet, puts in a greater message of Ezekiel, and just ties it all together in just this beautiful stream of thought into the most beautiful and complex of literary features in the history of the world. Yet the Jews thought he was a common, uneducated man. So, brethren, I am excited for us to go together into the writings of John as we understand the works of a common, uneducated man. Over the last few weeks, Matt, Eric, Grace, and Daniel have been studying some with me. All of us have just been so excited to see all of the complexity, but all of just the beauty of John's writings. And as we get into them, I can't wait for us to see the witness, the story, the narrative of this common, uneducated man. Get out your songbooks, please. So I know that was lightning speed tonight. Thank you for your attention. I just wanted to introduce us to John. I'll go back over some of this in a few weeks. But for me at least, I saw in our Paul class last quarter, it's really important to understand the biographical approach to really get the message of what a book is getting at. You can read John without knowing his backstory, but you can't really read John without his backstory. So I think understanding this will help us in as a few weeks we get into the Gospel of John and see his beauty. John, of course, pens in the most figurative and literary ways imaginable the story of salvation of God's people. That Jesus Christ came in the form of flesh, died on a cross, was resurrected 3 days later, and has now breathed out new life to the entirety of this world. If you need to respond to the Lord's invitation and come to Jesus this very evening, come forward while we stand and sing.